Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to another Rahalastava Book Club. We have our first ever returning author. Which, when you think how many authors there are in the world, what's he got over me that he's come back already? It's Greg Jenner, and he's talking about his fabulous new children's book, but it's good for adults too, You Are History. How are you, Greg?
I am well. I'm back. I'm like a boomerang.
You were very kind because early you were, I think, maybe our fourth or fifth guest, but I'd happened to read an older book quite recently, so that was part of the reason I sort of tapped you up. So I think it's only fair that you get to come back and publicise a newer book, which is very good. I've been reading it with my daughter Phoebe. Tell us what prompted you to come up with this one, and what your view of what it's about is, please.
It's a cold, hard, money-grabbing... No, it's... you know, there's no money in children's books. It's all about the joy of it. No, it's... the book is called You Are History, and it is 50 ordinary objects a kid will use every day, and the history of them, a global history, the stuff that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily look at and think, well, that's interesting, because we use it all the time, and it's boring, and it's ordinary. But actually, ordinary stuff is often extraordinary. And the idea was to try and write a book that any kid, regardless of who they are, could pick up and go, oh, I do that. I use those. And then they kind of go, hang on a second. This goes back thousands of years, back to the Stone Age, back to the Bronze Age, back to, you know, ancient China or Japan or wherever. So it's a fun illustrated book that is hopefully getting kids into history, but also just sort of going, look, if you look around you, the stuff in your house genuinely has an amazing history, and we don't give it two thoughts because we're all just like, nah, whatever, don't care. But it's good stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And even as an adult, and even as an adult who studied history and is very interested in history, there is there is lots of stuff in here that I didn't know, or lots of things that I had forgotten if I did know. So it's a really great, you know, I love a good kids' history book is great because it reminds you as an adult of the stuff you don't know. And also, I think with this, when I studied history at school, it was very, very Eurocentric and very, very Britain-centric and England-centric. And this book takes us all over the world and has the history of from many different places as well, which I think is terrific.
Yeah, and I think that's really important these days. I think it's... I mean, I went through the whole education system, you know, up to master's degree level. I didn't do my PhD. I couldn't afford it. But I went all the way up without really ever doing African history, East Asian history or South Asian history. Like, you just like enormous not even like countries, but like continents of the world. Yeah. That we just was like, no, we're not doing those. And that just seems weird that the history of the world can be so easily sort of smushed down to just Hitler and the Tudors. And you sort of go, there we go. You're now trained as a historian. Off you go. And so, yeah, it's nice to diversify a bit and look around the world. And also, we live in a global world, right? We live in a connected world. Our history is increasingly the history of other countries, other, you know, whether it's empire, whether it's trade, whether it's wars, whether it's pandemics. We're all interconnected. And as the book hopefully makes the case, some of the stuff that we think of as really ordinary and just part of our daily lives, well, it comes from the other side of the planet. And that often was extraordinary at the time. It was, you know, when it first started happening, people were like, blimey, this has come from, you know, thousands of miles away, huge shipping trade networks to bring it. And now you can order it next day off Amazon and it shows up and you go, oh, great, lovely, just needed one of those. But back in the day, it would have been months and months and months to bring something. It would have been hugely lucrative. Yeah.
It is a very funny book, and it's lovely to read it alongside. We've been reading it together. I've been reading it, but my daughter is now capable of reading on her own as well, so she's been reading it too. But it's nice to get shared laughs. Her first big laugh, it is very funny, Greg. My first big laugh that really tickled Phoebe was about Richard the Raker. I don't know if you remember that particular part.
I do.
I mean, it's not a very funny story, really, but it got big laughs from my evil daughter.
It's funny at a distance. It's tragic up close. Yeah, Richard the Raker was a medieval toilet cleaner. So that makes him sound like the products you put down your toilet. He wasn't a bleach. He was a human who cleaned toilets. In medieval times, he lived in England. He was called a gong farmer, which is the medieval word for a toilet cleaner, and he drowned in feces because unfortunately he fell through the floorboards. They were rotten. He fell through the floorboards on his day off, and that's what I find. That's where the joke is that he spent his days cleaning other people's feces, and then he got home and unfortunately fell through his own toilet on his day off. And that's the joke, isn't it? I mean, it's horrible. It's grim, but that is ultimately, if you're going to have to die, I suppose make it ironic. So poor guy.
And he's literally gone down in history as a result.
Literally gone down.
We wouldn't probably have heard of Richard the Raker if this hadn't happened to him. He lived in the 1300s when things were pretty bad anyway. So, you know, all in all, it's a good result for Richard.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the 14th century is the time of the Black Death. It's the time of huge flooding. It's the Hundred Years' War. I suppose drowning in your own shit is probably not that bad a way to go, all considered.
But I love it when like stories like that come through the historical record, because obviously like there's not loads of stuff from the 1300s that makes it to us, and certainly not loads of stuff about ordinary people. So that's a story that has been grasped onto. Do you know where that story, what the source for that story was?
Yeah, so these are coroner reports. So we get these sorts of stories usually from investigations into whether someone has died by accident or malice. You know, has someone killed them or has it been an accident? And so we get there are some really fascinating ones. I'm trying to think of some of the funniest ones. I mean, again, I used to write these on Horrible Histories on the stupid death sketches. But there was a Tudor guy, I think it was, who was trying to shoot his bow and arrow, and the arrow got stuck. It got lodged in the bow, and he did that classic thing of, you know, you never meant to sort of peer into the barrel of a gun. He did the exact same thing with a bow. He sort of peered into it, and of course it dislodged into his face and killed him. There was a guy who shot an arrow directly up into the sky and to see how high it could go, and of course it just came back down and hit him on the top of the head and killed him. There are a lot of people who unfortunately died somewhat stupidly, and from far away it's now funny, but at the time would have been very sad. But yeah, we do have these coroner records of death by misadventure. Drowning is incredibly common in the medieval world.
Right.
So people, they didn't have the clothes that, you know, they would the clothes would absorb all the water, and so you would get very heavy, but also the shock of the cold. Really, really sad how many people were drowned. But it was a very, very common also to be killed by pigs. That was another huge issue. Wild feral pigs would just like eat kids and attack people, and that was quite bad. So you have to sort of imagine a world where arrows are being shot in the air, people are drowning and shit, and then you've got like feral hogs going for your kids. So it's quite a scary time.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is lots of funny stuff in there. There's, you know, you home in on Tutankhamun's pants that, you know, which is obviously another a big laugh point that we have. So we have a pair of his pants. They're quite impressive.
Well, not just one pair, Richard, 145 spare pairs.
You are right, yes, of course.
He was buried with so many pants. and we don't really know why so many. Obviously, he's there for the afterlife. I guess they're sort of planning ahead and thinking what he might need. I don't know, 145 is so specific, and it's so many. Like, I get it if they gave him like seven, you know, like a mum packing the kid off to go on a week sort of, you know, scout camp or something. Seven pants, you'd be like, yeah, fair enough. 145, it's a weird number.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's about. But you can see his pants in a museum in Egypt. They're on display.
It's so lucky that wasn't all that was in there. You know, I don't know if that would have been quite the excitement. I can see wonderful things. 147 pairs of pants.
Howard Carter is breaking in. It's just wife fronts everywhere.
And yeah, you know, it is fascinating. I have to say that what I really like about it is that you'd as much as it's a fun little jaunt through history, you don't dodge the big subjects. And so, you know, it's not overwhelmed by the big subjects, but you certainly go into mentioning the Holocaust in a personal and moving way as well, slavery and American civil rights. So you're sort of covering the big subjects as well. Was that important to you to get those across as well?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, when you're writing a book for kids, you have a responsibility to not just make them laugh and give them, you know, something jolly to look at bedtime or whatever, but also just give them a little bit of knowledge about some of the big stuff in history, which is horrible and scary. And of course, the thing about the Holocaust, about civil rights movement, about slavery, is that these things have echoes and legacies to this day. They're still really present in our world. There are still survivors. There are still people who have been touched by those horrible atrocities and crimes and injustices. And it's kind of important to make sure that kids growing up can sort of know that some of this stuff wasn't so far away and still really will affect us now. So yeah, you got to have a bit of that in the book, but you can't have too much because it's meant to be funny, it's meant to be light. Yeah. And also, you don't want to scare kids or upset them, you know. It's you have to give a little bit of knowledge so they can go, oh, okay, and then they might go and look it up in another book if they feel ready. But yeah, a little bit of something just to get them started.
I think it's very well judged. It's exactly that, you know. It's a book that you, as I say, you can read together and you'll laugh together. But then, it is important to acknowledge the awful things that history has given us. And you know, I think just it's done with a light touch, Greg, which I think is great. But without trivializing any of those experiences. And you know, and I think it is important that kids are away, because you sort of say, you know, you say, oh, we only covered Hitler and we covered whatever, but you know, it is so much part of history now that actually kids don't necessarily know about even World War II. Like a 7 or 8 year old kid isn't like, you know, I think I mentioned Hitler and she didn't know who Hitler was, which is kind of nice, but also, you know, we need to get that information through.
That is really interesting, isn't it? It is that thing of like, for people our generation, I think Hitler is like the sort of the absolute epitome of evil. And you can, you know, you did a Hitler moustache show. You've done all sorts of sort of comedy referencing on that. And it makes plenty of sense if you're talking to another adult of the same age to sort of be able to name check Hitler, and everyone goes, oh god, yeah, that guy. But it's really interesting that how do you introduce that to a child, and as the years roll on and it gets further and further away, how do you keep it current? You know, the big challenge at the moment is Holocaust education. Is that, you know, we're seeing a huge rise in Holocaust denial, and that's kind of scary, right? Because that's 13 million people who were annihilated on purpose, and my family were among them, and it's just incredibly evil. And it happened not that long ago, and there are survivors still alive. I interviewed one in January. You know, she's very elderly, but she's incredibly with it and phenomenally eloquent. And I couldn't believe the horrors she'd lived through. And I was chatting to her on the Zoom call, you know, this lady in her 90s. And you just sort of look at people like that and think, you survived the worst possible atrocity. And there are people out there who don't believe it happened. And it's just, it's really, really alarming. And so we do have to keep an eye on these things. But, you know, that's not It's not easy to do. And if you're writing a funny book for kids, you can't just sort of go, all right, kids, now let's do the Holocaust, because it's such a gear shift. It's such a tonal whiplash effect to suddenly stop and then talk about the deliberate murder of so many people. But yeah, you have
it's such a hard thing to get across to a child. And yeah, you know, it is. And so I think, again, this is perfect. But then again, what I like about the book is it's very much Greg Jennings is very much a sort of character in the book, as much as, you know, in that bit where you mention your family connection, but you've got a little introduction bit where you talk about your own day and what annoys you about these little things. So you're very much a character and an accessible character in that is bringing us into this historical world.
This was not my idea. This is my editor's idea. If it's up to me, I stay well out of everything. I try and, if I could host my own podcast without being there, that would be amazing. My editors were like, we really want you to be in the book, and we want you to have a sort of section called Greg's Greatest, where you're on like every page. And it's like, really? So, yes, I'm all over the blooming book, which is very, very weird to see. And it's also very strange when you see yourself drawn as a cartoon.
Yeah.
50 different ways. There's cartoons of me on the toilet with my sort of, you know, my underpants around my ankles. And it's like, I'd never imagined I'd ever see this in a book. Here I am taking a dump in a children's book. It just doesn't feel like it ever should have happened. But yes, I'm in there mostly because actually when you're talking to kids, it's quite nice to sort of feel like you're chatting with them rather than,
yeah,
writing at them. You know, I think it's the same when you're doing podcasts or, you know, speaking to a grown-up audience. I'm all about the kind of conversational thing and making it feel chatty and intimate and warm and friendly and a bit like you're chatting to a mate or a friend or someone, you know, someone in the family who, you know, maybe a little bit older but knows some stuff. And so I'm always trying to find a way of connecting that doesn't feel so formal, because a lot of history books are quite formal. You know, that's good sometimes. Sometimes it's very important to be formal. But if you're trying to get people on board who don't love history, or they're young and they're starting out, I think it's quite nice to sort of go, hey, I'm Greg, this is what I do. I look like this. Here's me on the toilet. Sorry.
I think it's great because, you know, I think also having kids again and remembering being a kid, the idea of history is so confusing when you're young, you know, that you can't really... quite, and partly in joke humor, but partly in reality, my kids will go, were you around when the telephone was invented or that sort of thing? But they don't know, you know, my son doesn't know, you know, he knows there were Vikings, but he can't really grasp that the Vikings were like 1500 years ago or, you know, or whatever. So it's, which isn't surprising. So you have to do it in stages and you have to do it in this way. So and I think by picking out the interesting little gobbits and the funny bits, that really is the way. And my daughter loves this. You know, my daughter at the moment, I've read it all, but we're about halfway through together because we're just doing it a couple of subjects at a time each night. You know, but she wants the book, which is a great you know, a great compliment to the book. I think, and a great it sort of shows how great the book is that someone. I mean, she is interested in history, I think, but I think it does really bring it, you know, together, I think, in that way.
Oh, well, I'm very glad to hear that. And it's very kind of you to say. And, you know, it took 3 years to write this book, actually. I think when I sort of sat down, I was thinking, oh, this would be easy enough. You know, it's a kid's book and I've done horrible histories for 11 years. I know some stuff about history. I'll just bash out some. And actually then you kind of go, oh, God, no, this needs to be good. This needs to be good. And it needs to be well organized. It's got to make sense on the page, and it's got to be beautifully illustrated, and every illustration has to be accurate, historically accurate, and it's got to be funny. And then the really hard thing about writing kids books is the word limit is super specific. So it's 35,000 words, which is a lot of words for a kid. So it's very sort of, there's loads of information in there, but like you literally cannot fit more words on the page than they will give you room for. So you're like, they're like, okay, you have 317 words in this section. It's like, really? Not 318? No, 317. What if I use two short words? How short? You're negotiating over like the length of a syllable, you know, because it literally has to just physically fit on the page. There are 144 pages. There are 50 objects. There's only so much space. So it's almost like magazine design, which I'd never done before. It's not like Horrible Histories. It's not like a podcast. It's not like writing a book for grown-ups. It literally was like layout. So it took 3 years of writing and writing and rewriting and editing, and then working with the illustrator, Jenny Taylor, it does an amazing job on this, trying to get it all to fit and then to make sense and then for it to flow and each page to have jokes and then each page to have facts and then each page to have illustrations and then the next page is you start again and it's like, oh God. So yeah, it's a lot more work than I thought it would be. And actually the adult book that I wrote at the same time, Ask a Historian, was way easier to write. That was, you know, 120,000 words, 50 different subjects. But that was a doddle. This was so much harder.
Well, the illustrations are fantastic. Is it Jenny Taylor? Jenny Taylor did the illustrations, which do really compliment it. Again, we using you as a character, but also, I mean, and I guess, you know, it's interesting to think because I thought there must be so much responsibility to get the facts to be true. I mean, there's a couple of things you say, I don't think this one is true, or, you know, this is just a story. So, but there must, would you also want to do, you know, one, that's part of history is the things that aren't true and the things that are stories. But yeah, sure. I hadn't considered that Jenny also had to make sure that everything was accurate in all, but it's a beautiful looking book. So, you know, it's a lovely gift because it's a beautiful gift. It's a beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's a hardback and it's also available in audiobook too. So the lovely thing about the book is that it's so gorgeous to pick up. It's hardback. It's in full color. It's got a lovely heft to it. It's very high quality paper. I'm very impressed.
It is.
But the audiobook exists too, and I narrated that. I did it with COVID, actually. I tested positive for COVID, and I knew that I wouldn't have time to record it any other time because it was 3 days before my 40th birthday. So I recorded it on my own in my shed with COVID and just no producer, no director, just like did the whole thing on my own, like an absolute madman. And sort of talking to myself and then sent it off and then went to bed with COVID. So, but so it sounds good. You can't tell.
It might just be you hallucinating. Oh my God.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's a dog coming in. Well, it's
funny you say that. So my 40th birthday was also, so I missed my 40th birthday because of COVID, but it was also when the Queen died. Wow. So that whole week, I was recording an audiobook for 2 days straight. I had COVID, my 40th birthday, and the Queen died. And I'm pretty sure I hallucinated half of that. So I'm not.
Yeah, the Queen's still alive, Greg. What are you talking about?
Oh, right, okay, yeah. Yeah, I had a fever for two of those days for sure. So yeah, it's a lovely book. And the audiobook version, if kids love listening to stuff, or if they enjoyed my children's podcast in the pandemic, Homeschool History, it's a nice way again. I mean, actually, what you can do is you can buy the hard copy and then you could you can listen along and sort of trace with your fingers and sort of see, because some kids, you know, if some kids process information differently, you know, there are children out there with different needs and different desires and different ways of enjoying listening or reading and together, or they might be visually impaired. So that to have the audiobook version also is really nice because it means the book can exist in a slightly different format with different jokes, you know, jokes for the radio.
Yeah. Stop trying to sell two copies of every book.
Sorry.
But I think that it seriously is that is a lovely thing to say. It is such a lovely object itself that I think it is probably is worth buying both. If you want to listen to the audiobook, if you want to listen to the COVID-fueled rantings of Greg.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
There's a few things that come back. There's a few characters that come back that I wouldn't say were the major characters in history. A couple of mentions. John Joseph Merlin, who I'd never heard of, is mentioned twice in this book. So he's
yeah.
So if this is the only history book that ever survives, If all the risks disappear and this is it, people are going to think John Joseph Merlin was a pretty important guy. Do you want to tell us about why he's mentioned twice?
I like John Joseph Merlin. He was a Belgian inventor. He was a musical instrument inventor. That was his main job. But he also invented roller skates. And famously, he was entertaining at a party in London in the 18th century. And he was whizzing around the party on his brand new roller skates while playing violin at the same time. Because he was a musician and everyone was like, oh, look at him. He's very fancy. He's whizzing around. But unfortunately, he hadn't invented brakes for the skates. And so he just careened headlong into an enormous mirror and very nearly died. sort of very badly cut by all the sort of shards of glass everywhere. So I just really like that. It's just a very good visual image of a man hurtling on roller skates into a mirror. It's sort of a slapstick image, but actually it was probably very serious at the time. But it's... But yeah, the history of mirrors is in the book because mirrors are really interesting. They're really, really interesting. You know, we have mirrors from the Stone Age, from Châtelhoyuc, the first ever town 9,000 years ago. They're cosmetic mirrors. Women were buried with them. And we have the story of a Roman emperor who was so paranoid about being murdered by assassins that he made all the walls of his palace shine and shimmer like mirrors so he could see people sneaking up behind him. And I kind of love that fact. And there's also... This is not in the kids' book. I'm assuming there are not children listening to this, but there was a famous Roman sort of sex pest who loved using convex and concave mirrors while having sex. In fact, probably while sexually assaulting his enslaved servants, horribly enough, but he used them to make everything look bigger. So he would hold mirrors up so that he could see his penis look larger. And in the end, his enslaved servants murdered him and the emperor let them off. Yeah, you know what, he was an absolute bell end, sure. So yes, there are, even in Roman times, people were using mirrors to check themselves out and to make everything look bigger.
Well, maybe you need to,
that's
do
not in the kids book,
maybe do an after dark version, because I know you mentioned the advent of Coca-Cola with just saying, oh, they're made of cocoa, these leaves from this plant, but without saying too much about what the original ingredients of Coca-Cola
were. Yep, absolutely. The original ingredients were pure cocaine, 100% Colombian, yeah. So, yes, there's some things that kids can maybe wait a few years before they come back around to.
Yeah. Well, John Joseph Merlin, never heard of him. Very interesting. Again, I think like when people multitask and do different things, Joseph Priestley, who I had heard of but was unaware... Mm. That he'd invented the fizzy drink and named the rubber.
Yeah, yeah.
Because rubber plants are called rubber plants, but rubber plants are named after rubbers rather than the other way around, right? That's what I've gleaned? Is what I can glean that correctly?
Yeah, so the plants have various names. Latex is the product. In French, it's caoutchouc was the name of the plant, which was a sort of mistranslation of a... an Oaxacan word, the language spoken by the Aztecs. But Joseph Priestley, another 18th century sort of natural scientist and very sort of brilliant man, he noticed that if you took this plant, this sort of spongy, rubbery, well, you know, rubbery is the word,
yeah.
But if you rubbed it on pencil, it erased it. And he went, ah, interesting. So if you rub it, it goes. So that's where we get the word rubber from. Was him rubbing it. So the rubber plant is named after the action of rubbing.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Aztecs used to chew it. You used to chew it as chewing gum. It's called chicle, I think. He also discovered carbonization. So the idea of fizzy drinks, so lemonade and so on. So the Schweppes company in the 18th century was founded soon after Priestley noticed that you could add carbon dioxide to liquids. So yeah, there's a sort of fun period of history in the 18th century where you've got these sort of natural scientists running around rubbing things and prodding things and measuring things and setting fire to things and going, hang on a minute.
Also, probably as an important historical figure for school children, the man who invented or named the rubber and the man who invented fizzy drinks. He's right up there, right? He's got to be number.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got to be in your top three most important historical figures. Joseph Priestley.
Absolutely.
And vulcanization becomes a big theme in this book. But, you know, again, you realize how important vulcanization is as a just what you're mentioning, that, that people would drown because their clothes were waterproof. But what a big step that was in moving the human race forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's rubber was used initially not really for clothing or anything like that. And then in the early 1800s, people start using it for, so you get like, the idea of the Wellington boot comes in quite late. But you get Charles McIntosh, who sort of comes up with the idea of the waterproof coat. And then vulcanization comes along. It's Charles Goodyear. And it's this notion that if you sort of superheat the rubber plant, it becomes waterproof and strong and resilient. And it doesn't smell, is the other problem. So prior to that, the smell of it was absolutely disgusting. People used to be thrown off of trains and carriages for wearing rubber clothes because it would just they smelled just revolting. So the vulcanization process got rid of that as well. So that then gives you tires. So having rubberized, heated, treated, makes it strong and resilient. It means you can put it on cars and trucks and lorries and stuff. So it just changes the world. You know, the invention of this technology just completely transforms technology and also transportation and all sorts of things. So, yeah, sometimes you get these little cute stories and then you sort of go, hang on, whoa, this is huge. This is a huge story. It starts off as, one guy doing a bit of rubbing and another guy accidentally setting fire to something and going, oh, I think I've invented industrial rubber. That's handy.
Yeah. And there's a few things the few things that I enjoyed that were new to me. I didn't know the reason why Paris is an hour ahead of the UK when it's so close to the UK. That's an interesting story, which I'm surprised about. But tell us why that is, Greg.
Yeah, so Paris and London should be on the same time because it's all to do with longitude and latitude and all that kind of stuff. And it's the time zones, which were invented in the 1880s. You're meant to add an extra hour every 15 degrees. And Paris and London are close enough that they should be sharing the same time. But in World War II, the Nazis invaded France and changed the time to German time. And when the Nazis were defeated, the French didn't change it back. They decided they would keep in time with European trade and commerce, and they would maintain that new time that they'd been given. And so now London and Paris have a 1 hour difference.
Yeah.
But they shouldn't. Scientifically speaking, they shouldn't be doing that at all. And then, of course, in terms of time zones, there's only one time zone in all of China. There should be five or six, probably, but the government are like, no, we're all in the same time. So it's like dark until 10 a.m. in several parts of China. So time zones, again, have a fascinating history. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah, no, it's well, it's all good stuff. And, I like the, it was interesting to see that the communications and the leap forward in sort of telegrams and phones led to this thing called Americanitis or neurasthenia. I think I'm saying
that's
that right. Which is, technology going so fast that people couldn't cope with the speed they were now getting the news, because it would have taken weeks in the past, and now suddenly you could get news of something almost instantaneously or within a few hours.
That's right. In the 1850s, you get this sort of arrival of the telegraph machine, which is super important. And you have these two parallel wars or conflicts happening simultaneously. The Crimean War, which obviously is happening in Crimea, which is a huge distance from London. And then you have the Indian War of Resistance, Rebellion, what used to be called the Indian Mutiny, but we don't call it anymore because that's much too sort of British imperial. They happened, in the same decade, and news from India took 40 days to reach London. But news from the Crimean War arrived that afternoon. So it's genuinely believed that William Russell was the first ever war correspondent. He went out to report on the battles of the Crimea for the Times and was writing back sort of stories about what was happening out there. These stories then inspired Florence Nightingale and Mary Seacole to go out there and become nurses, and also Alexis Soyer, the French celebrity chef. But it's also quite possible that the Russians were reading his stories in the press because they were so quickly telegraphed back to London and then Russian spies could read the Times and then send back what they'd read in the Times back to the Russian front. Right. So funny enough, actually, it sort of probably helped with espionage too. We're not sure about that. That's a theory, but you have this incredible sudden acceleration, and neurasthenia or Americanitis, as it was called, is this sudden kind of nervous condition that gets diagnosed by various psychologists. That it's always men, primarily men, and sometimes women, and brilliant, clever, brainy white men with the biggest of brains were suddenly getting nosebleeds and headaches and exhaustion because the world was going too quickly. There's too much information. There's too much news. You can't process things anymore. Stocks and shares go up and down in an hour. You know, suddenly reports are coming in from Crimea that afternoon. What? Crimea is a long way away. How are you doing this? You know, you get the Reuters news agency being, you know, so it's. It's this sort of sudden acceleration in the world where the introduction of the telegraph machine, you get two machines, actually. You get Cook and Wheatstone in Britain, and in America it's Morse. But that just changes the world. It just accelerates the speed of communication so radically, so quickly, that there is this sort of profound trauma where people running around going, I can't handle it, it's too much. And I guess we've seen plenty of that recently with people saying, oh, you know, social media, the internet and TikTok, it's all bad for our brains. Well, is it? I don't know. I think there's probably exaggerations there. But it's really interesting to see that the Victorians were equally bewildered and terrified of new technologies as well as excited by them. The telephone, for example, people were really scared about telephones coming into their home. They were worried about the privacy aspects. Yes. And we have amazing letters. We have etiquette letters to sort of etiquette manuals and magazines saying, when a gentleman phones a lady, should he be wearing trousers? And should he be standing up? Can you catch diseases down the line? You know, will poor people phone me and ask for money? All these sort of worries that they have. So it's quite funny. The French were really worried that the invention of the telephone would increase the amount of extramarital affairs because women would be able to call their lovers without their husbands knowing. Right. Classic French. That's what they're worried about.
Rightly so.
My wife cheat on me. Yeah, well, maybe.
Wait till the. I mean, it is interesting to put that in the modern context and how quickly technology has moved. You know, it must have been relatively slowly in Victorian times that a new thing would come along. But yeah, something like it'd be very interesting to see how the Greg Jenner of 100 years time will look back at the internet age and what it did to us. I mean, there's plenty there. And I also like, I would think I did know this before that hello was sort of became a big thing as a result of it being the word that was decided you would answer the phone by saying hello. It wasn't really a word that was used as a greeting before that, but it was nearly ahoy was nearly the chosen word. So we'd nearly
Which
have
is great.
Ahoy magazine would be instead of Mellow magazine.
Ahoy magazine, you'd have Lionel Richie saying, ahoy, is it me you're looking for? It would be amazing. Hello was chosen because of the clear syllables. And it doesn't sound like any other word in the English language. And also, it was chosen because at the time it was believed that the phone line would always be open. So now, of course, we pick up the phone and we dial someone and we connect the call. But in the 1880s and 90s, it was believed that the phone line would always be on. And so it would just be on in the background and you'd have to signal to someone, oh, I want to talk to you now. So you'd have to use a word that wasn't normal in conversation. And so that word would be a new word. What we call a neologism, and hello was the word that was coined, and it's now probably the most spoken word on the planet in terms of you can go anywhere in the world and say hello to someone and they can probably say hello back. So it's kind of fascinating how quickly that spread. But and then the young women who worked in the call centers, you know, connecting the calls, were called the hello girls. That was their sort of job title.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think the only chapter that made me feel particularly old and like I was part of history, which I am, was there's a whole chapter about computer games, the history of computer games.
Yeah.
And then actually knowing, you know, I was there as all these things were happening. Although actually computer games are, well, I think they're about as old as me. I think 67 was when I was born and maybe when the first computer game was available in homes, I think, if I'm remembering rightly. But all the stuff about Pac-Man and Space Invaders and all that, and Pong, I mean, that's my life. Yeah. And here it is now in a history book being read by my daughter as something ancient. So it's not so unreasonable to ask if I'm as old as the phone and I'm as old as
exactly. I feel the same. I've having turned 40, I suddenly feel the crushing weight of middle age hitting me. But the oldest computer game potentially would be at the World Fair in the 1940s, and this was a digitalization of a medieval Chinese game. And so actually it's possible a child's great grandparents were playing them maybe back in the 40s. But yeah, it, obviously it's a huge thing, the kind of the Ataris and the whatever. And for me, it was Tetris, you know. And yes, as soon as I wrote that, I had the Tetris music go around my head. And during the audiobook recording, while I had COVID and was slightly febrile, I started singing it. And then I sort of, it just would not leave my brain. And so for the entire thing, I was just sort of going, do, 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 just over and over. And I feel like it's a sort of curse now. I can't quite get rid of it in my head. But yet, some of those games are so old now, like Sonic the Hedgehog and Street Fighter 2. Like Street Fighter 2 is still quite famous. You can still sort of go up to people and go, Hadouken! And they kind of know what you're doing, and it's kind of weird. But some of those games are so old. It's really fascinating.
Well, look, there's loads of extra stuff, and I don't want to give it all away. I love the stuff. I mean, the Peruvian instant mash from hundreds of years ago is an incredible thing. Johann Gutenberg, that's not his name. And you translate it.
Yeah,
that's very interesting. There's bikes, people trying to stop women riding bikes is fascinating.
Yes.
Again, another big subject, really, that it is interesting to talk to my daughter about that, and that people could, you know, have such the idea that their faces would change if they went too fast on bicycles. Their faces would become as frozen as bicycle faces, and just absolute nuts stuff that unfortunately we still are dealing with in the real world. How much of your time is spent like noting down facts for potential podcasts and TV shows and books in the future? You spend your whole time kind of, have you got a special notebook for this stuff, or is your brain just good enough to remember?
I must
put this in a book one day.
I've got a decent memory, and that's one of the sort of advantages of being a historian, is having a good memory. But yeah, I do have a folder full of random, there's a folder on my computer called General History Things, and it's sort of subdivided into like 90 different eras. And whenever I find something interesting, I take a photo of it and bung it in there and, you know, sort of remember. But yeah, there's so much history. Everywhere you look, absolutely everything has a history. You know, the road you live in, the clothes you wear. You know, you're wearing a T-shirt right now. The T-shirts have a fascinating history. They were underwear until about 70 years ago. You know, the glasses you're wearing right now, not to sort of give away your middle age like me, but, you know, the glasses have a really interesting history. You know, they go back to the 13th century. It's much older than you might expect. You know, people would not imagine that medieval people were wearing glasses, but yeah, that's how old they are. So absolutely everything has a history. Headphones you're wearing right now has a history. Cables have a history. Microphones I'm speaking into right now have a really interesting history. Just everything in our lives comes from somewhere else. And quite often those stories are incredible. And, you know, when you look at the invention of the television, for example, well, the inventor of the TV, a brilliant Scotsman, he made the first one with jam bottles and jam jars and knitting needles. You know, he literally random stuff out of his kitchen cupboard, and that's how he built the first TV. And you just go, what do you mean biscuit tins and jam jars and knitting needles? How have you made a TV out of literally the stuff you find in a sort of bric-a-brac? But yeah, that's what the first TV was made of. So there's just incredible stuff everywhere. And I have a very nice job where I get to point at it and go, oh, I'll pop it in a book.
Yeah, well, it's a lovely way of doing it. Basically going through your day and the objects you would encounter in the day. But exactly right. That, I mean, you realise how much of human evolution is down to our ability to pass on ideas and write down ideas. You know, how all it makes us different from the other animals who maybe have learned a few little tricks through the time, but has to be passed on through however they pass on their little bits of information. We've got this vast store of ideas, and they're written down or they're passed from person to person and improved upon. And so it really is a fascinating way of looking at history through objects. And, you know, as we say, touch on some serious stuff, touch on some funny stuff, but it does give you a nice comprehensive look at humanity and how we've got to the ridiculous place we're at the moment. So thank you for that. Are you working on more books, Greg?
I have to write more children's books. I'm going to be writing a children's book series, hopefully, I can't tell you what it is yet because I don't know, but that's the idea. It's going to be hopefully a series of books all in a kind of similar theme. and yeah, making more of Your Dead to Me, the podcast. Sure. I do, and you know, bits of bobs here and there of stuff. It's all very nice. I'm very lucky to get to sort of do lots of variety, like yourself, actually, you know, a variety of things, all with history at the center. But yeah, it's a nice life. I can't complain.
And are there any books that you're reading at the moment you'd like to recommend, or anything that you've read recently? Is there anything that's...
Oh, that's interesting. For your badgers, I'm trying to think what's going to be a really good thing to recommend right now. There are some. I mean, I love Susie Dent's latest book. I love Susie Dent anyway. But like, it's full of lovely, lovely words. But there's Peter Frankopan has got a new book coming out quite soon that looks amazing. And his last book, The Silk Roads, was this incredible history of Asia and the Middle East. And it sold like 2.5 million copies, which is insane for a history book. You know, a best-selling history book sells 50,000 copies if you're lucky. He's got a big, big new history coming out quite soon. And Peter is the cleverest person I've ever met. He's terrifying. He's so nice. It's really annoying. But he's like, he speaks stupid number of languages. And he's a professor of global history at Oxford. And his book, I'm sure, will be just a vast repository of all the things I wish I knew but didn't. So look out for that, because he's very big brain.
Brilliant. Oh, look, Greg, it's always an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I highly recommend You Are History if you've got
Thank
kids,
you.
Or if you haven't, just buy it for yourself and hide it with your pornography so no one knows that you're reading a children's book. But it's, you know, there's so much in there, and you'll be able to impress people at dinner parties with your amazing knowledge. if I could ever remember these things, they are nearly always fall out of my brain almost straight away, sadly, these days. But it's a strong recommend and you've written lots of other books as well, which we've had you on about ask a historian. But there are plenty of other books out there for Greg. A million years in a day is a similar theme. I suppose that's the adult version of this book, right?
Exactly that. This book is basically the children's version of A Million Years in a Day, which is about the history of ordinary stuff we all do.
Yeah.
That was more about the things we do in a day, whereas this is more about objects. But absolutely, they are the same book for different audiences in different format. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So if you're an adult, maybe buy that one, but get the kids one as well, because it's really good fun having cartoons of Greg on a toilet in them, or you could just draw Greg in a toilet in the grown-up version. I'll try that one. Lovely to talk to you, as always, Greg. I hope to see you soon. Thank you very much. Not quite sure who's next week. It might be Rebecca Rag Sykes talking about Kindred, hopefully, which is
a brilliant book. It's an amazing book. Yeah, she's been on the really podcast, and I highly recommend Dr. Becky. She's amazing. So that's a fantastic book. Highly recommended.
Great. Good. All right. Thank you, Greg. See you, Greg. Thank you. And thank you very much to Chris Evans, not that one, and to Ben Evans, not that one either, probably, who does all of our social media clips. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.